This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tackle the very, very important subject of chronic fatigue syndrome, also sometimes known as ME, myalgic encephalitis. We are going to talk to an expert. She herself has personal experience with chronic fatigue syndrome because she was afflicted with it at age 16. She is trained as a chiropractor originally at the Palmer College of Chiropractic, and she graduated later with honors from the University of Bridgeport Human Nutrition Institute master's program. She now resides in Munich, Germany, where she has studied at the Technical University of Munich. And she's also host of her own podcast on Spoonie Radio. She's Dr. Courtney Craig. Courtney, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine. You once visited us around a year or so ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking me back.
Okay, so we're ready. We're anxious to hear an update on your activities. First of all, you know, why Munich, Germany? Why is it there that you decided to set up practice and make it your headquarters?
Well, like so many others, I grew tired of New York City, the hustle and bustle. Chronic illness or not, it's not an easy city to live in. So I was pretty desperate for a change. And I also really wanted to advance my education and learn laboratory skills so I could have a better understanding of the literature, particularly as it relates to nutrition. Education in Germany, for the most part, is free, even for foreigners. So that was also a big selling point for me. And they, of course, have top universities. So I got lucky, and I was accepted here at TUM. And I should mention that the programs are offered in English, learning nutrition and biomedical sciences. So it really gave me a glimpse into the methodology of research science as it relates to nutrition.
Well, that's fantastic. So it gives us a little background on how you personally got interested in CFS as a sufferer of that condition.
Right. So this past year actually was a celebration of, I guess you could call it a celebration, but 20 years since my first diagnosis, which is quite a thing to swallow. Through that whole time, it's been ups and downs with my own health and with the knowledge that we have available about the disease. And that continues to go and go. At present, 20 years later. So it's been interesting to see how the condition has changed in me over all those years as well. And it's really changed since moving here as well. So all these kind of life events, as well as just the passage of time, have made the experience of having ME/CFS very different for me.
So you've also made yourself a living laboratory for some of the things you've studied in terms of some of the medical and lifestyle approaches that can impact the status of patients with CFS.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is really why I've been interested in everything I've studied, particularly nutrition, because it's been such an excellent tool for me. And granted, you know, this is an incurable disease, but it's very manageable, and I like to approach it with things that I can control. And diet and supplements, those are things that I can control to manage my symptoms effectively. Of course, you know, you'll have some bad days here and there, but I've kind of, over time, refined what really works for me to prevent relapse, to prevent bad days as much as possible.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about CFS and, you know, the whole terminology associated with this. Some people have stated that the term CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, sort of undermines the seriousness of this condition. In the past, they've derisively dubbed it yuppie flu. You know, various celebrities have said they have chronic fatigue syndrome, but, you know, maybe they're just suffering from ordinary burnout. Do we tend to trivialize it when we call it CFS?
Yeah, I mean, this is still a problem, and it's still the butt of some jokes, right? To use a term like this, and at the same time, you know, governing bodies and the scientists and experts out there have tried to change the terminology. I think most recently it was systemic exertion intolerance disease, mm-hmm. or SIDE, which did not catch on at all, and it's not being used at all.
But it's
present.
Actually very germane, because that is truly one of the hallmarks of the disorder. You know, folks out there, if you complain of fatigue, you know, you're tired, the first question I'll ask you in my office, and I'm sure Courtney would ask you if you're consulting her, is, what's your reaction to exercise? And many people, you know, sometimes I'll feel tired, and I'll say, well, you know, let me go down to the pool, I'll swim a few laps, I come out feeling energized and revitalized. But that's not the case with chronic fatigue syndrome, is it?
Right. No, and that's really the hallmark defining symptom of this condition is you have this unrelenting fatigue, sometimes even flu-like symptoms. So the immune response responds after exertion. Now, that could be physical exertion or that could be mental exertion. And I find this happens to me, too. I mm-hmm. sit down to work one day. I'm writing mm-hmm. for my website or other work. And then it triggers, you know, an inflammatory response. I feel slightly mm-hmm. feverish. I feel pain, you know, all of these things. So it's not just physical exertion. It can mm-hmm. be mental exertion.
Right. And, you know, part of the impediment to recognition of this disease and progress in research towards addressing it is the difficulty of ascertaining, you know, who precisely has CFS, because laboratory tests, it's kind of elusive when it comes to, there's no marker, there's no blood test. I mean, there's a blood test for HIV, it's a clear cut. There's, you know, blood tests to determine if you have diabetes, and so on and so on. When it comes to CFS, the hallmarks of the disease, it's more a symptomatic diagnosis, right?
Right. It's very subjective. And this is really the crux of the problem with this condition, having been in it as a sufferer and as a scientist or researcher for 20 years. We haven't really moved the needle on this so much. You know, and you see headlines now more often, oh, potential biomarker for CFS, potential mm-hmm. biomarker here. But the problem with all of these is we are not comparing this finding to other fatiguing illnesses. We're just comparing abnormalities to healthy individuals. But we have to consider that people with MS, people with mental conditions like depression, people with other types of autoimmune diseases also experience fatigue. So we have to compare any potential biomarker that we've found in ME/CFS to other fatiguing illnesses. Otherwise, it's not specific. Maybe it's just a result of being fatigued or deconditioned or whatever it is. And that's really what researchers desperately need to do right now, mm-hmm. Is start comparing potential biomarkers to other fatiguing illnesses so that we can get as specific as possible to decide what makes ME/CFS so much different than every other chronic condition.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of a wastebasket diagnosis, too, because just like another condition with an acronym, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, it's, you know, when you don't have colitis and when you don't have Crohn's disease and when you don't have parasites and all the tests are negative, then they relegate you to the IBS wastebasket. Similarly, right. With CFS, it's sort of like, well, we can't find anything. In fact, you've written a book. It's an e-book, which is available on Amazon. All my test results are normal, a smart mm-hmm. guide to testing for chronic fatigue syndrome. So is it possible that there are many shades and subtypes of CFS? It's just not one monolithic disease?
Well, we don't really know that for sure yet. Again, that's going to be really hard to pick out because every patient presents in such a different way. And some people have different triggers. For me, myself, and for many, it was a virus that you never recover from. But for other people, it's a traumatic injury that's musculoskeletal, or it's an emotional event in their life. So it's
perhaps
going to be
a chemical exposure
to determine that. Yeah, or an exposure to mold or other sort of chemical pollutants. Absolutely. So, you know, understanding the origins of this is going to be very, very difficult to tease apart. But getting back to this idea of testing, and this is one thing that I encountered myself, you know, in the early days. It took me years to even get this diagnosis. And on average, I think most patients experience 3 to 5 years to get a diagnosis. So that's how trash can it is. Mm-hmm. We need to get better at that. And part of that just comes with, you know, basic medical care. You're not getting adequate assessment, you know, and that's really what I write about a lot in the book you mentioned, because it happened to me. You know, I wasn't having a thorough evaluation of the entire system. You know, doctors have tunnel vision and don't order all of the tests that they should. They certainly aren't ordering more comprehensive testing like functional medicine testing or testing for exposures or things like this. So number one, I think the most important thing for patients that present with fatigue of any kind for over 6 months, you need a thorough evaluation that looks at all of these things.
Mm-hmm. And looks for, you know, other possible more remediable causes of fatigue, such as hypothyroidism.
Absolutely.
Perhaps some form of adrenal dysfunction, and on it goes. But what's this? Is there some unifying theory now in the best circles about what causes CFS? Does it have to do with hyper excitation of the immune system, or perpetually inappropriately activated cytokines, something like that going on?
Yeah, again, we have literature on all of those things, but none of them are specific to the condition. We have had an influx of research, I think, within the last 5, maybe 10 years. A lot more research dollars are being put in. The NIH recently put in about $7 million to defund multi-center projects. So there's more interest.
Still
there's
really
more
a drop
research
in the bucket, considering, you know,
really
the billions expended on other conditions. I mean, it's estimated
yeah,
that there's
really
maybe a million or two with, you know, pretty hardcore CFS in the United States or
yeah, if you do the numbers and compare the amount suffering versus the research dollars, it is sad. But nonetheless, has increased over the years, and we're getting some really interesting research coming out. But as far as grand unifying theme, it's a little hard to kind of piece everything together. We have groups looking at metabolomics, which kind of consistently shows a low metabolic state in ME/CFS patients, where we're not producing energy efficiently. Mm-hmm. We have trouble with the breakdown of carbohydrates. Glycolysis is hindered. We also have studies looking at the gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. And that's consistently showing dysbiosis lack of diversity. We have new studies looking at autoantibodies, which seem to be very common as well. One of the most interesting areas of research right now, I think, is looking at new imaging techniques to image the brain.
Yeah,
not just perfusion, which has been known for quite some time, the lack of blood flow to the brain, but actually measuring
the energetics,
inflammation in the brain, the energetics of the brain. Yes. Mm-hmm. So we see some neuroinflammatory signs in new imaging studies. My theory of how all these are connected is what they all have in common, rather, is they all have a chronic inflammatory state, which is not really surprising because chronic disease itself is inflammatory. We have excess oxidative stress, we have mitochondrial dysfunction, and all of these things that kind of perpetuate the disease. And you mentioned cytokines, and all of those studies are kind of all over the place as well. But that just ties into the fact that in this condition, we have excess oxidative stress, excess inflammation. And I think the most severe cases, the cases of patients who are bedridden, who have sensory sensitivity to light and sound, inability to get out of bed, these I think are the most severe as far as their inflammatory load, their oxidative stress mm-hmm. load.
Yeah, they literally want to lie in a darkened room, and you know, even sound is jarring for them.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing is, you know, this is not a cause, right? Because pretty much all chronic disease has inflammation as a common factor. But what we need to determine is what either genetic or epigenetic or what sort of exposures that triggered this whole event set the stage for this to perpetuate in a way that's different than other chronic diseases. And uncovering that is going to be very tricky.
And there's been a lot of controversy over whether there's a psychological contribution. In fact, big pushback from the CFS community against people who say, hey, you know, get over it. You know, take cognitive behavioral therapy. Stop thinking of yourself as a sick, debilitated person. Begin cautiously to exercise. Break through your limitations that you feel when you're tired when you exercise. And then there's been enormous pushback against that because the people who don't like that approach feel that the critics who say it's a psychological condition just don't understand the fundamentals of CFS.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to read the literature that's out there by the field of psychiatry that are trying to push out this kind of theory, because if you look at their papers, they don't cite any of the biomedical research. They don't cite any of the high-profile papers. So it's like they have their heads in the sand. And this is such an issue that I'm tired of hearing about, because it's kind of like kicking the dead horse. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, this disease is defined by inability to exert oneself physically or mentally. So how on earth is exercise, graded or otherwise, going to be beneficial mm-hmm. when the one thing that makes this disease unique is our intolerance to exertion?
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like telling people who have a heat intolerance to, you know, gradually have more and more exposure
yeah, and gradually.
To sauna, you know, so they get used to it.
Yeah, that's not what happens here, and it causes so much harm to patients, and I see stories of this all the time online, and it's heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. And this is a real problem, especially in Europe. This is less of a problem, I think, in the U.S., but here in Europe, these ideas are pushed even harder. Here in Germany, in the U.K., pretty much all over Europe. And this is what the government insists that the providers do first for patients with this diagnosis, regardless of age, regardless of anything, its severity. And it causes so much harm, because most of these patients that undergo these graded exercise therapies relapse, some of them so detrimentally that they're bedridden afterward. So, you know, rule number one, do no harm. And this is one initiative that has done so much harm to so many patients. It's mm-hmm. very, very sad.
Is there evidence that this is viral? Because at various times they've come up with the idea that, oh, we can just use antivirals. In fact, even some AIDS drugs on patients who have chronic fatigue syndrome, and just wipe out the virus and then they'll feel good. A lot of patients still come to me, you know, after being seen by their primary care. And when they can find nothing, they do an EBV virus panel, Epstein-Barr virus panel, and they say, well, it's abnormal, and so you have, quote, Epstein-Barr virus, and they're relegated to the scrap heap. There's, well, you have a virus, we don't yet have treatments for that, but at least we have an explanation. It's a virus. This is a virus.
Yeah, when you do a test like that, it was a virus. There's no, I mean, very seldom is the virus active mm-hmm. when you actually run these blood tests. And these are viruses that are very common, endemic in most of the population.
If you look for them, you're going to find them in the vast majority
yeah,
of individuals.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And they're all, you know, chronic reactivation of viruses associated with all sorts of different diseases like MS and different types of autoimmunity. But the thing is here, again, talking about etiology of the condition, and some people, most, I think, people present with a post-viral type fatigue. Mm-hmm. And it could be EBV, it could be CMV, it could be HHV6, it could be cytomegalo, I just said that one, but mycoplasma pneumonia, I mean, you name it.
Some undiscovered agent, but it just triggers an overall immune response where it appears that the Epstein-Barr virus is reactivated, but maybe it's being co-activated by something.
Right, yeah. We haven't really pieced that together, but I think that's the most common trigger in most patients is a viral infection that doesn't seem to fully recover from.
Right.
So
efforts to kill a virus, and they've used some very powerful even HIV medications, and there was actually a few years back hints of success with patients, but then that whole project crashed and burned. And then integrative doctors sometimes use things like ozone, hydrogen peroxide, various harsh treatments to try and extirpate some sort of hidden virus. Mm-hmm. Has that paid off in any way?
Yeah, most clinicians have gotten away from prescribing antivirals because they're not so effective. And I think the main reason for that is you have to know when the virus is reactivated. When the virus is reactivated and you take a medication geared to that virus, it's going to be more effective than when it's dormant, but potentially still causing immune modulatory problems. Yeah, as far as natural approaches, I don't necessarily think it's a good idea to target the virus specifically unless you know it's active, but instead support the immune system in general. Take a more broad view to prevent the viral reactivation in the first place.
Well, let's take a look at some of the basic theories behind this. You've actually written and talked about the impact of the microbiome on the immune system and signaling that can affect the brain, the nervous system, the muscles, energy metabolism. What's going on there?
Oh, the microbiome is slowly becoming less of a black box for us as we learn more with the literature. It's the hot topic of the century, I think. It's still really challenging as a clinician, and particularly a clinician working with ME/CFS patients, to know exactly what to do here. We know that almost 40% or more of ME/CFS patients have some form of IBS. A large percentage also has small intestinal bowel overgrowth. I seldom find a patient that doesn't have any gut issues whatsoever, and I do stool testing and these kind of things. So the goal is, of course, to understand if there are pathogenic bacteria present and they need to be treated using antimicrobials, or if there's just a general dysbiosis, you need to support some sort of protocol that's going to improve diversity. And I think diet, as well as fasting, is one of the best ways to achieve that.
And one of the issues that you've tackled lately is the possible role of a ketogenic diet in helping patients with this condition. And the hint is that they do have issues related to their carbohydrate metabolism.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, any sort of major shift in dietary change we know can dramatically alter the community and the microbiome. So switching to a ketogenic diet, or even if you're starting on a standard diet and switching to just a low carbohydrate diet, is going to have dramatic shifts in the gut microbiome. And we know ketogenic diets are going to be more favorable to short chain fatty acids, which have very anti-inflammatory effects. And there's a lot of interesting things happening in the gut when you add high fats to the diet, particularly from median chain triglycerides and polyunsaturated fats.
And how about the brain? Because the brain utilizes short chain fatty acids and ketones differently than the normal source of energy, which is glucose.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we are seeing so much research now in the power of beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is the main ketone body produced through a ketogenic diet, and its ability, again, it's one that actually crosses the blood-brain barrier. Most fats do not. And its ability to act as a signaling molecule in the brain, where it can interact with the immune cells of the brain, the microglia, to limit inflammatory cytokine release. It can affect neuroplasticity. But basically, it has a kind of neuroprotective and anti-inflammatory effect. which is very potent, especially if you continue the diet for longer periods of time. We know that the more you're on ketogenic diets, the more you have receptors on the brain that take up the ketones. Mm-hmm. So the longer you're on it, the more
you can train your brain to be more receptive to that.
These things take time.
Do you induce the beta-hydroxybutyrate via diet changes, or can it be taken as a supplement or a precursor?
I think either is certainly a viable option. I'm very interested in using exogenous ketones. The mm-hmm. problem is they're rather expensive for the average person to acquire. You can use just fasting or a standard ketogenic diet, but you want to ensure that you're increasing beta-hydroxybutyrate. So if you're going to fast, you need at least 18 hours to increase blood levels of beta-hydroxybutyrate. It might be less if you're on a strict ketogenic diet. If you use ketone salts or esters, those are also very effective for increasing beta-hydroxybutyrate, but they tend to be very expensive. I have been using medium-chain triglycerides.
MCT oil.
MCT oils, mm-hmm. yes. This is a cheaper way to do it, but it is proven to be just as effective. But you have to take a bit more, and it can cause some gastrointestinal distress, but it resolves after a few days.
And you've written about some of this on your website. Let's give it out before we pause for before we go to part two. What is that again? It's CourtneyCraig.com?
DrCourtneyCraig.com.
Dr. Courtney. Let's spell it. It's a a little exotic for some people.
I have a long name. Yes, DrCourtneyCraig.com. So CourtneyCraig.com.
Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Okay, folks, because we divide our podcast into two parts, we're gonna move on in part two. To talk about specific strategies. We can talk about supplements for CFS, for mitochondrial support, and we'll talk a little more about the personal journey of today's guest. She's Courtney Craig. She's a DC, a chiropractor, with special interest in nutrition and in remediating the problems of patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.